Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, today we have a very varied show, from the Affordable Health Care Act to wine for the holidays to renegade chefs and fearless eaters. You'll want to stay tuned to KPCW and The Mountain Life.
Good morning, Lynn. First, we'll be joined by Carolyn Rose, Director of Nursing at Summit County Health Department. Carolyn will be one of the panelists at the KPCW Community Forum on the Affordable Health Care on December 2nd, and she'll talk us through some simple points and clarify confusion over the ACA.
And then Lisa Bishop Forbes, she's the winemaker at Chalk Hill Estates in Sonoma, California. She'll be talking about wine pairings for the holidays. Now, that's not necessarily wine pairing with food. That's just wine pairing with a holiday.
And life.
And life.
Wine pairing with skiing.
Yes.
Wine pairing with coffee?
Perhaps.
It's been known to happen.
Wine pairing with the mountain life. There we go.
And
go ahead.
And finally, Dana Goodyear, staff writer for The New Yorker, who will talk about her book, Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. Just in time for the holidays, talk of food. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us.
Support for KPCW comes from the Utah Olympic Park. Join the Utah Olympic Park in supporting our world-class athletes and their Olympic journey. Don't miss Utah's Road to Sochi featured event. The Bobsled and Skeleton World Cup, December 6th and 7th, free admission. Event details and VIP tickets are available online at UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
This is Zane Holmquist, executive chef from the Glitterton Restaurant at Stein Erickson Lodge, Deer Valley, a proud sponsor of KPCW. For 16 years, I've been creating fresh seasonal menus, highlighting locally sourced products, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week, and Jazz Sunday brunch. 645-6455 or steinlodge.com.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Join us for Cool Science Radio, Thursdays at 9 a.m.
From the discovery of new dinosaurs to the science of an avalanche.
From the secret technology behind Facebook to nanotechnology.
Deciphering science and tech in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way.
It's Cool Science Radio. If we understand it, so can you.
Thursdays at 9 a.m., only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Peak Art and Frame.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, have you thought about logging into healthcare.gov to find out what you need to find out about the Affordable Health Care Act? And then do you rethink it and say you'll do it after Thanksgiving and then maybe after the holidays and then maybe, well, then it's 2014? So our first guest is Carolyn Rose. She's the nursing director at the Summit County Health Department, and she's joining us to give us just some easy-to-grasp concepts and tips. And today is a precursor to the KPCW Community Forum taking place on Monday, December 2nd. It's all about the Affordable Health Care Act, and Carolyn will be one of the panelists. She's now joining us in the studio, and good morning to you, Carolyn.
Good morning, Lynn. Good morning, Tim.
So this is just practice for you for the panel on Monday. And, you know, really, I mean, I think, well, it's probably obvious to everyone, the reason that KPCW wanted to do a community forum on the Health Care Act is that it's just so confusing. And it's probably even confusing for you, even though you work in the industry. But maybe you could just start by telling us what are the things that you've learned that most help the average consumer?
Well, we haven't had very many people ask or come into the health department to ask about that. However, I don't know if it's because people just are putting it off, like what you've said, or if it's because they're just confused and they don't know what to do. When I went on healthcare.gov, I actually find it very helpful, but I know healthcare, and I've worked a little bit with on the insurance side as well. But everything is pretty much there, and it walks you through it. I think it's much easier than some other types of applications I've ever gone through. But it's sometimes it's difficult if you don't go through and click on each topic that you need to find out about. So it's a little time consuming, but I think all the information is there.
Carolyn, do you have a sense of how many people in Summit County would find this useful? I mean, the kind of the need side of healthcare. Are there a lot of uninsured who would look to fill their insurance needs with the Affordable Health Care Act?
Yes, there's a lot. And there's a lot of people that are self-employed here also. And there's part of the website called Avenue H, and that's specific to Utah. And that's for a small employer to go to see what they can qualify for, what they can offer their employees. But because there are a lot of self-insured people, they need to go on the website and just see, you know, what's there for them, what they qualify for, if they qualify for a tax credit, you know, exactly what kind of category they're going to fit in. There's five types. Gold, silver, bronze, platinum, something like that.
And would it make sense for just about anybody to take a look if you're self-insured? I mean, I'm self-insured. I don't have an employer program. So would it make sense for me to take a look and just get a sense of what's offered and what the different levels are and how to qualify and just kind of – or is it really people who are kind of at the lower end of income scales and maybe haven't been insured in the past?
No, I think, if it was me, I would definitely look at it, because the tax credits go on to 400% of poverty level, which I really hate that word, poverty level,
right.
But, you know, with how much you make, and actually, that's quite a bit of money. So, you know, I think that a lot of the general working class here in Park City should go on and look at it. The only thing is, if you are currently employed and your employer offers insurance, you can still go out to that website and look for different insurance. However, you are not eligible for any of the tax credit.
Okay. So a couple of questions here. First of all, I've heard of people going to healthcare.gov, but then I've also heard of people just disregarding that and going to the Utah marketplace, not necessarily this Avenue H, because that's just for small businesses.
Correct.
Right? But what is the marketplace? What's the website for the Utah marketplace? Do you know?
Actually, you can just go to healthcare.gov, and from there, it'll ask you what state you're in, and then that is the same website that Utah's using.
Okay.
So you just put in Utah, and it brings you right back to the marketplace. It's just kind of a term.
I see. Okay, so I went on healthcare.gov, and I didn't get very far this morning before I got sidetracked. Go figure. But the first thing it says is that you're not going to enter your income. First off, you're just going to enter a few questions. One of those is, where do you live? So that must get you onto the Utah marketplace.
Correct.
But then how far down the line before they ask you what your income is so you know that they're going to channel you the right...
Not very far. It was pretty quick. They ask you, I'm trying to think, where you live, how many people are in your family, and then I think it goes into income, or I can't remember exactly, but it's fairly quickly that you can find out. Plus, there's a calculator that you can go in and kind of estimate. And from what I understand, and I have to say to kind of back me up, nobody really knows right now what's going to happen. And so that's why all of us are just kind of guessing and directing people. But actually going through the entire application, I'm not eligible to do that. However, in what I've seen, you know, you can go to this calculator and you have family, how many people in the family, if it's a single person, and then you put your income, and I can't remember if it's your adjusted gross income or something else. And then it will kind of guide you through that and lead you kind of automatically into the next section that you need to fill out.
Okay. So you at the Summit County Health Department have a sheet, I believe it's both in English and Spanish, that just is kind of a how-to.
Yes.
Go through it. It's very simple.
Right.
But it's funny because I don't think anything is too simple when it comes to this, because I think mostly because we've heard how confusing it is. So even maybe if it is simple, we're putting our heads in the sand and not going into it.
Right. I think so too. And I think that I don't think it's that difficult. However, you know, when I do TurboTax, and I'm not a tax person, but if I can follow TurboTax and you can follow TurboTax, I think you should probably be able to go through and follow the healthcare.gov. I don't know what the results are. I don't know comparatively if people are going to be paying more or less. I don't have a clue. It's very individualistic.
And is the idea to get enough people, well, to get everybody signed up by the specific date, which has now been extended slightly into 2014, is my recollection. They just did a slight extension.
Right.
So as of that deadline, they take the people and they create a pool, and then they determine kind of what the pricing is based on how many people have signed up and that kind of thing? Or is it you don't know? Okay.
From what I've gone through on the website, they give you right there what you're going to be paying.
Okay.
And I do know that each health insurance company or any company that offers health insurance, such as, you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Select Care, all those,
right,
they have to have a plan that is put in the marketplace. And then you pick from that, and I noticed that there was, if you go on the website, there's a whole list of different insurance plans, and then you go into what level you want. So somebody, you know, like the young skiers around here, they aren't going to really need much, so they'll probably go for the catastrophic plan,
right,
which could devastate them if they get hurt skiing. And then you kind of go up from there. And if you want to, you can pay a lot of money and get most everything covered.
Right. Well, I went through a little scare recently with my insurance agent, who called me and said, oh, well, we don't have to worry about it because you're good for a year, but you'll eventually be forced out of your current plan. This is what he told me. You'll be forced out of your current plan and to take a new plan, and your premium is going to quadruple. And I was like, well, that just doesn't seem right.
No.
But it was definitely, it felt like I was being frightened into sort of an anti-Affordable Health Care Act position, which just was bizarre. I mean, I thought that was very strange. I haven't looked, and now I need to do the follow-up to see what the information really is out there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of what's going on, it seems to me. A lot of scare tactics.
Always remember that your insurance broker makes money off of this too.
Right.
Right. So perhaps what he was trying to do is to scare you into a better plan, maybe one. I don't know what kind of plan you have.
Well,
Tim,
he was telling me just to hold tight and not do anything currently.
Okay.
But I mean, and I'm not sure where it was coming from, but it definitely made me go, huh, that just doesn't seem right.
Right. And now I think people, maybe you would fit this profile that, you're not the ski bum who's just come to town, working seasonally, but you choose catastrophic because it is of lesser expense, but also because you're healthy.
That's what I've done. Yeah.
And so,
I have catastrophic coverage.
Right. And that's what I've done as well. That's what I do for my children. However, all the accidents and injuries they get, I wish I had a different plan. but I'm wondering, for whom does it change the most? Is it for healthy people with the catastrophic coverage? Sounds like quadrupling is a big change, but we don't know if that's true.
Yeah, and we don't know what's true, I don't think, at this point.
No. And I think that Jason Stevenson, who's also on the panel from Utah Health Policy Project, he knows a whole lot more about this than I do.
About the specific plans that are going to be available.
About more specific plans, and there are people that you can call and go in person to talk to, and there's a list of those places on the website. So all of those sorts of things. I think it's just kind of an unknown for most of us.
And so what is your area of expertise, Carolyn? I mean, as a nursing director for the health department, you see, and I know you're not affiliated with the People's Health Clinic, but it is in your same building. And
right.
So the perspective that you're going to bring to the community forum is what?
Probably what the health department is planning on doing. And again, everything's such an unknown, but I try to keep up with what's going on and what the plans are offering. And then I also have to look at our funding. We get grants from the federal government and also from the state government, and those are gradually decreasing over the next 5 years because CDC is thinking, well, people are going to have insurance and we can just bill the insurance. So I'm looking at what we can do as far as billing insurances and doing contracts and that. But there's still going to be a lot of people without anything. So we will still be a safety net for that. But I'm going to have to balance between decreased funding and what we can offer and what the cost is going to be.
Okay. Well, the community forum, did you have one more question, Tim? Okay. The community forum taking place Monday, December 2nd. It's at the Jim Santee Auditorium, hosted by KPCW. The social hour begins at 5 p.m., and I can just imagine you're socializing, Carolyn, talking about the healthcare.
Yeah.
There we go. And then the panel actually begins at 6. So, Carolyn Rose, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be back with the winemaker at Chalk Hill Estates, Lisa Bishop Forbes, to talk about wine and holiday pairings. Pairings with wine and the mountain life. There we go.
KPCW's new classified ads are now on Facebook. Join the Facebook group KPCW Classifieds and Rideboard and see what's being sold, hired, rented, and searched for today. Post what you're getting rid of or what you're looking for free. Another service for locals, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is more than a fun look at the week's news. We also provide you with the latest developments in medicine and beer.
And Bud does sound like the noise that people tend to make when they're having a heart attack.
Yeah,
Bud, 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 Bud.
Wait, Wait, the news quiz from NPR. It might just save your life.
Heard on KPCW Saturday morning at 9, thanks to 350 Main and the Spur Bar and Grill.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, Vice President and Branch Manager at Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch, a proud supporter of KPCW. We understand the importance of local banking. We offer banking products from checking and savings accounts to business lending. Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch is located at 1225 Deer Valley Drive or online at grandvalleybank.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, from Affordable Health Care Act to wine, which would you rather talk about?
You have to ask. This is my kind of pairing.
Yeah, there we go. Well, the Chalk Hill Estates Winery has received nearly 100 ratings of 90 or higher by the Wine Spectator, the Wine Advocate, and the Wine Enthusiast. And talking about a California winery, other than the obvious Thanksgiving and general festive holiday tie-in, has a tie-in to Utah. Indeed. Well, as Utah has unique topography, climatic, and geological diversity, so too does the land the Chalk Hill Estate sits on. Not that we really needed a tie-in to talk about wine on the day before Thanksgiving, but we're joined now on the phone from Chalk Hill Estates by the director of winemaking, Lisa Bishop Forbes, to hear about wine pairings for the holiday. And good morning to you, Lisa.
Good morning. How are you?
We are well here in Utah, where it's sunny and warm. What's the weather like in California?
Sunny and warm.
probably warmer than it is here. Warm is all relative.
Oh, no, it's pretty warm here, Lynn. We're losing the cross-country ski track as we speak.
That's right. So you've just finished up your crush, you call it, is your wine harvest. Is that right?
Yep. Just finished. Last fruit came in right at the very end of October. So, yep. Done. It was a great harvest.
Oh, it was? And what made it a great harvest?
Everything has to do with the weather, as I'm sure you know up there, too, with, everything that goes on in Park City. But, yeah, it was a very, warm but, nice weather. There were no heat spikes. It didn't rain at all. Actually, we've had virtually no rain since probably June. But the crop was good size, but not too big. Flavors were really concentrated, and it's just a great year all the way around.
And so what does that mean specifically, that type of weather, for your particular harvest at Chalk Hill Estates? From what I understand, you make your wine from, 100% of the grapes grown right there.
Yes. Yes, we do. And we're in somewhat of a unique area. We're technically part of the Russian River Appalachian, which is, known for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and it's typically a cool area. But we're in the warmest end of the Russian River Valley, and we're right near Alexander Valley, so we get some of the cool influences, some of the warm influences. So we're able to grow, anything from Pinot Gris to Syrah and Cabernet. It's a very unique site for that.
And Lisa, just so it can help the people know exactly where that Russian River Valley is, what's the biggest town around here? Would it be Santa Rosa?
Santa Rosa, yes, definitely, is the biggest town. We're Healdsburg address where we are. We're close to the town of Windsor, so kind of north middle Sonoma County.
Sonoma County. So you are a part of the Sonoma region.
Yes, yes, definitely. We're, kind of as crow flies, if you go straight out the eastern part of the winery property, we'd be just north of Calistoga.
And so,
in a good spot.
And it's a good spot. And, you say you didn't have any rain, and that's a good thing, not to have rain since June. And how do you keep the plants growing? Do you irrigate?
We do. It's good and bad. Obviously, we definitely need the water. We're in a big deficit situation right now. But as far as growing grapes and making wine, we'd rather not have rain, certainly during the harvest. But we do irrigate. We've got some wells on our property and collect rain in during the wintertime and the spring in our irrigation lakes and things like that. So we try to be as self-contained as possible. There were some, hand-wringing moments. Of course, the water levels were, dropping a bit, but we made it through, and we're waiting for rain. We thought there was going to be some tomorrow, but it doesn't look like it.
And Lisa, what's special about Chalk Hill as far as getting so many 90 ratings and above with over the years with your wines? That's a pretty exceptional record.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it is. It takes a lot of hard work, and our director of vineyard operations, great guy named Mark Lingenfelder, is really responsible for a lot of that. He manages all of our vineyards. He's been with the winery since 1980, and he's got a really top-notch crew of guys out there growing grapes for us. We keep our yields relatively low, so the flavors are concentrated, and then at the winery, I've got an awesome crew of mostly guys who take care of the wine, and everyone takes a great deal of pride in what we do, and we control everything from grapes to bottle, and I think that really makes a difference.
And so, Lisa, would you consider yourself a boutique winery? We hear that term.
We're not really small enough for boutique, really. I always think of boutique sort of, 5,000 cases or less. We make about 40,000 cases. That we do a lot of, 200 and 300 case bottlings for our wine club and our tasting room. So we do a lot of, what I would consider boutique level, definitely hands-on winemaking. But we also, make a lot of Chardonnay that is available across the country for people to enjoy.
Right. And so you're really known most for your Chardonnays in a widespread area, right?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Since the early 90s, really. It's been our hallmark.
Wow. All this talk about wine, and I'm getting a little craving, and it's only 9:30 in the morning here, Lisa.
Well, it's probably 5:30 somewhere, Tim.
Yeah, it probably is. I'd have to go to London. Okay, so we're in London.
How about that Chardonnay?
So, Lisa, how about the pairings? Why don't you guide us through some of your favorite pairings for Thanksgiving?
Thanksgiving's tricky. I know Lynn and I have talked about it before. It just with, turkey and dressing all the way to, cranberry sauce and all the various flavors that go along. I always look for something that has some pretty good acidity, so something with some weight to it that will, you know, kind of cut through the richness of the food. So this year we had some fun and made a little Malbec rosé.
Hmm.
So we're going to have that. And we also make Pinot Gris, which is a definitely a texture-based wine. It's got some nice acidity and a lot of richness. So that's a really good turkey wine. And then I'll probably also open our Viognier, which is one that we make just a couple hundred cases for our tasting room and our wine club. It's floral and fruity, but crisp and still, you know, has some weight to hold up to the food. So that's going to be our Thanksgiving. But I was thinking about this yesterday, and I think, you know, people view it as a celebration, which it should be. Sparkling wine or champagne is always terrific. And again, the bubbles and the acidity and maybe a little sweetness are great with the food.
Ooh, sounds good. In fact, I got a couple of bottles of Prosecco last night. Am I doing okay,
yummy.
Lisa?
Oh, yeah. I think that would be great. I just had some the other night at a lovely dinner with pasta with mushrooms and a cream sauce, and it was really good.
Now, Lisa, I'm going to expose my ignorance about wines just completely here, be very vulnerable. But is Pinot Gris similar to Pinot Grigio? Is it kind of the American version, or are those two completely different grapes and wines?
They're exactly the same grape. Oh. One's, you know, Pinot Gris is the French name, and Pinot Grigio is the Italian name. So same grape variety. The styles are different. Usually, I mean, we use Pinot Gris because it's our wine's a little more toward the rich, you know, kind of bigger Alsatian style, you know, French style of Pinot Gris, whereas the Italian wines tend to be a little brighter, a little more fruity, a little lower alcohol, you know, generally probably a more approachable style, one that you maybe don't have to think about so much. But they are exactly the same grape in that related to Pinot Noir, it's related to Pinot Blanc, and the grapes are actually kind of a purpley mauve color. They're really pretty.
Hmm. Now, this Malbec Rosé, this is interesting to me, Lisa, because I was in France last summer, and I was in this big region of rosé down on the Mediterranean coast, and we drank lots of rosé. It's not like the rosé that we think of, what's that, white Zinfandel here,
yeah.
Right? Not at all, but now this Malbec Rosé is throwing me off because I like to drink Malbec as a red wine, so explain that a little bit.
Right. Well, it's sort of a byproduct of making our red Malbec, which we use in, you know, some club wines and in our estate red. So what we do, you know, there are a couple of different ways to approach rosé. We actually bleed off juice from our red tanks. It actually, you know, it concentrates the red wines a little bit more, and then we get some lovely kind of, oh, I don't know what color it would be. It's darker than a salmon color for sure, kind of a watermelon color. Really yummy juice that we pull off, it's got a lot of strawberry flavors, and it's just really pretty. So some people approach rosé right from the beginning, picking grapes specifically to make that. You know, ours is a little bit different, but it's really fun. We don't make much, a couple hundred cases of that too, but it's a fun wine.
Lisa, is there a way to describe or a character that is kind of across the board would describe your wines because of the soils, the region, the weather of Chalk Hill? Is there something that is a character that, you know, is across the board with all your wines?
Oh, that's hard. We do so many different things, but you know, my approach is having richness with balance at the same time. So concentrated flavors, but an elegant finish. And that's what I try to do. You know, some of our wines are, you know, kind of on the bigger, you know, chunky, powerful end of the spectrum, which you need to have some of those too. But I think that because we're in a state, the wines are very identifiable year by year. You know, the vintages are obviously different, but you know, especially with our Chardonnay, you know, it's Chalk Hill Chardonnay. It smells like limes and baked apples.
I've heard you say concentrated flavors a couple of times in the interview. What do you mean exactly by concentrated flavors? How do you arrive at that?
I look for that basically, you know, through, you know, managing our vineyard yields and doing what we do in the winery too, is flavors that are how to describe it? They're intense and focused. Those are all bad words I shouldn't use, but the flavors are very persistent. There's no gap. There's no hollow spot in the middle, and the finish lasts a long time. So that's what I'm kind of looking at, is concentrated flavors. Something, you know, like if you look at beer, maybe like toward the stout end of the spectrum versus the Hefeweizen end of the spectrum, something like that, where, you know, there's richness and depth of flavor and no gaps.
Okay, those throwing around some great adjectives.
I'm getting really thirsty.
You've said that already.
Was 6 minutes ago.
Well, Lisa Bishop Forbes, winemaker at Chalk Hill Estates, thank you so much for joining us. One final thing, we've got about 30 seconds. What is trendy in wine? I mean, let's face it, wine is kind of trendy. What's trendy now that we might not know about?
I think, well, what's getting a lot of buzz lately is, you know, what people are calling natural wines, which are, you know, basically crushing the grapes and letting them do their thing. Very, very minimal intervention from a winemaker. And some kind of more old-fashioned varieties are becoming popular again, like things like Trousseau Gris and Carignan and Cinsault, and things that you don't hear of very much, but they're... There are, you know, kind of more young and up-and-coming winemakers and, you know, generally, you know, people that own their own small brands that are having a lot of fun playing around with varieties that, you know, most larger wineries either don't grow or don't really want to mess around with. So that's kind of fun. I think there's a lot of focus on uniqueness, which is great.
Okay. Well, Lisa, thanks so much for your time today. Lisa, again, the winemaker at Chalk Hill Estates. Not only is she that, she is my cousin. So happy Thanksgiving. Say hi to all the family, Lisa.
I will. Happy Thanksgiving to both of you, too.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
And this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I think we'll go ahead and welcome our next guest. Remember the recent story about the sting operation in Los Angeles where a sushi bar was found to be serving whale meat? And we've all heard about how the majority of the world eats most any insect and views bugs as either a normal part of any day's menu or maybe even a delicacy. Who hasn't tried escargot, clams, or oysters on the half shell? Well, in recent years, the trend in eating the exotic and the unusual has taken on an urgency and a momentum that surprises even the most courageous and open-minded foodies. In her new book, Anything That Moves, Dana Goodyear presents a simultaneously humorous adventure, a behind-the-scenes look, and an attempt to understand the environmental and sociological implications of the way we eat. And Dana is now joining us by phone to talk about her new book and, wow, from wine to weird food. Dana Goodyear, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So Anything That Moves, you take us in this book through the wildest stories about what people do with food. I had no idea.
The book really started with this observation that going out to a fancy meal in this country had gone from being something that was strictly an indulgence to something that was bound to challenge the diner's sense of what is edible. And I wanted to explore that and the features of the movement, the broadening of our palates, but also the broadening of the description of the person who is a foodie. What is a foodie now? It's not what a gourmet was in the mid-century. It's something much more universal.
Where's this coming from, Dana? I mean, this is kind of an evolution, and we've had a lot of food-related themes that we talk to people about on this show. There was a fellow who was eating invasive species, and Michael Pollan with his whole, you know, in defense of food. And this ties a lot of those themes together. But where does it come from? Where is the come from for this movement?
I think it comes from anxiety. America's institutions are faltering, and we are starting to eat like survivors. We've had such a predominance of our 20th century diet was so dominated by a couple of very processed forms of food, the factory farmed meat and the factory food. And there's a sense that that's not good for personal health, and it's not sustainable on a planetary level. And now we're going to need to look for some alternatives, and we're turning to cultures that have been eating more resourcefully than we have for millennia.
We talked to a fellow who recently told us that in 20 years you're not going to find the things that we find in the grocery stores currently because they're just not going to be available. They won't be able to be grown due to, you know, depletion of water resources and the acidification of our soils in the Central Valley of California, things of that nature. So this ties into that, sort of the apocalyptic vision of what could happen with food.
And some anticipation of that. That's why I think it's a hopeful movement, because it attempts to change our society before it's too late to change our society, and people are opening up to new kinds of food before it's a forced opening up, and deciding to say, this is edible too, this is delicious. People have been eating this around the world for a long time. I talked to a marine ecologist who studies the depletion of global fisheries, to speak to your point, and he have this very interesting point to make, and it contributed to my thinking that anything that moves would be a great title for the book. He said that the idea that we eat according to our preferences is actually not really what's going on. We eat what we can get, and for a long time, calamari was bait, and now it's bar food, and it's totally mainstream. So his point is that in Mexico and in China and in places where horses eaten and insects are eaten, these people are eating what they can get. They eat anything that moves, and that has gone from being a pejorative thing to say to being almost a compliment and something that foodies will boast about themselves.
But that brings up a real issue, which is if we're eating what we can get and our resources are diminishing, aren't we sort of into a cycle of continuing to deplete a ever-decreasing resource?
Well, the disruption of the ecosystem can sometimes end up emphasizing a new food source that wasn't emphasized before. So I just gave the example of calamari, but another one that I'm thinking about, because it right now feels a little bit uncomfortable, it feels, you know, exotic as food is, to Americans, is jellyfish, and something that I ate a lot of in the course of my reporting. Jellyfish are thriving right now in the oceans because we have fished out their predators, and so they've got these great conditions to succeed. There are cultures around the world that have been eating jellyfish tentacles for a long time, and they know how to make them really delicious, and I think that there are examples of problems that were caused by appetite having solutions that can come by way of appetite, and those are elegant fixes. You know, there may not be a limitless number of them, but...
So can you make jellyfish taste like calamari?
Well, anything battered, as we know, battered and fried is a good way to go with anything that you're nervous about eating. But the way that I've had it is actually, you know, almost like a plate of noodles, you know, those cellophane noodles or glass noodles that you get in Asian...
Oh, right.
...that they look like. And the vinaigrette is sort of sesame oil and rice wine, and it's wonderful. It's delicious. But, you know, I'm somebody who, like probably most people listening, grew up thinking jellyfish were something to avoid when swimming in the ocean.
Absolutely.
They're going to sting you.
Yeah, well, you know, that brings me to my question about the relationship that we have with food, both on the good end and on the bad end. So for me, I have had sea urchin spines sticking out of almost my entire body. And I know that sea urchin is eaten. I don't want to have anything to do with it. Same with jellyfish. And yet on the other end, and I would never eat, you know, stir-fried dog.
So are you talking about individual taste? I mean, everybody has their no-fly zones with food.
How much are we going out, striking out, looking for new foods, anything that moves? And how much are we hesitant, or how much does that repel us because of our emotional tie to food one way or another, the good or the bad?
Foodies seem to be saying that their previous exposure in childhood or culturally is not as relevant as the adventure that they can have with food. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of experimentation and self-invention among the foodies that I think is a very American trait, and people are deciding to make their eating habits, especially their more, you know, the eating experiences that make better stories or make better pictures on social media, they're making mm-hmm. that part of their identity. It's now becoming a mainstream American hobby.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, Dana, we live in a town where, you know, people are very athletic, and there's always one mm-hmm. more extreme thing that you can do, and one more, you know, adrenaline-producing thing that's even better than the last thing. And I'm wondering if that kind of plays into it as well, you know, seeing how exotic you can get, seeing how cutting-edge you can get with what you eat. I mean, is it this competitive thing?
It is competitive, and it is for thrill-seekers in a certain way. Some aspects of it are. I think that that is circumstantial. I think that that's something that's a byproduct of how unfamiliar some of these new ingredients are, that people are sort of psyching themselves up and making a big deal about it in that way. It's sort of a macho thing. But I believe that that will subside and will be left in a landscape where there's a broader array of options. The adrenaline junkie, extreme sports dimension of it, and the sort of testosterone-driven aspects of that people talk a lot about, and is this bro culture, and mm-hmm. it may be, and I think some people find that off-putting, but I see that as a way of making a conversation about food something that men are not afraid to have. It's not any longer an effete elite thing. It's something that an ordinary guy is allowed to care about.
Dan, it tying right into those themes, it used to be that, you know, exotic travel entailed some exotic eating. People who would, and people who did that were rare and far and few between. And when you saw what's happening with this movement becoming more mainstream and actually people being called foodies and identifying themselves as such, were there any indications of how that process came about, moving it from the exotic to the mainstream?
Well, I think that media has had a huge amount to do with it. The influence of the Food Network cannot be, and the Travel Channel too, because their food shows have been major leaders in this regard and influencers. That can't be overstated. But obviously, the internet has allowed every individual to be a broadcaster of her own experience. So the shifts in media have really influenced the widespread acceptance of foodism. In the book, I talk about a figure who is not as well known as maybe Anthony Bourdain, because he doesn't have a TV show, but it's a guy named Jonathan Gold, and he is the only food critic ever to have won a Pulitzer Prize. So he won it while at the LA Weekly, writing reviews mostly of small traditional ethnic hole-in-the-wall restaurants and emphasizing a kind of cuisine that was really low on the food chain, you know, not the big predators, but the things that feed the things that feed the predators, and that most Americans just have no experience of. And he really made those restaurants and those neighborhoods and those experiences accessible to a wide swath of Angelenos, and then eventually, as his word of his writing spread, to people who came to L.A. from outside of L.A. So there are these Pied Pipers, and they have their followings, and their followings are getting bigger and bigger, and now the people who follow those people have massive followings of their own.
Dana, are you a foodie?
I am a journalist who enjoys food, and I'm a pretty enthusiastic eater, and I try to be a pretty open eater. I don't identify myself that way because I want to believe that I'm more of an observer than that, but it was necessary to write this story to enter the world to in a pretty deep way and to immerse myself. And I needed to eat alongside the people I was writing about for a number of reasons, one of which is so that I could be a good guide to my readers and not be just saying, here's some wild stuff that people are eating. I wanted to be able to tell them what it tastes like and what it feels like in your mouth and could I eat it or couldn't I eat it. And another reason was that in order to be allowed to stay, you know, embedded, as it were, with these subcultures, there were often these sort of tests that were, they were eating tests. You know, are you going to eat that? Where do you like to eat? What kind of food do you like? And I felt that I needed to show them that I wasn't hostile to them. And one of the best way to show that was by eating. But I actually, in the course of writing the book, reporting the book, discovered my own limitations. It was not, for me, an experience about becoming a less discriminating eater. In some ways, I realized that I probably, like everybody, I have some rules that I operate by, and I was confronted with things that I could not eat for various reasons.
And what was the most bizarre thing that you were able to eat? What took you right to that boundary?
There are so many things, but the thing that comes to mind that was the strangest is something called Kopi Luwak, and this is a cup of coffee. So the weirdest thing that I consumed was a cup of coffee. It's coffee that is, the coffee beans are collected from the droppings of a Southeast Asian civet, wild civets, and they are sold for, depending on the harvest, about $1,000 a pound. So this was a $90 cup of coffee that I had. It was, to me, an example of just the most radical convergence of high and low. It's a feature of the food movement that the foods of poverty are being exalted and recast as elite. And the idea that this really challenges so many aspects of what we think of as edible. There's almost nobody in the world who thinks of something that's already been digested as an animal by an animal as edible. And yet this is something that you can buy at Dean and DeLuca and a few other really fancy specialty stores. And it's one of the most exquisite delicacies in the way that it's presented and the way that it's priced. And it tastes amazing, this coffee. It's so probably that context, that, you know, the elaborate ritual around drinking it, because it's brewed in a special way and it's poured at 3 different temperatures, and then the tasting notes are provided, and I'm just as susceptible as anyone is to tasting notes. And so I did, you know what? Darn it, it did taste like caramel and apple pie to me, and it was great, but I can't afford it, so I can't keep drinking it.
So to answer the question everyone's wondering right now, did it taste like poo?
Not at all.
That's amazing. So it may have been worth the $90 while you're not going to repeat that.
It was a great experience. It made me think a lot about what we value and how that's changing.
Right, right. So I just want to point out that in your book, it's almost like these little vignettes that you tell, and it's written in such a warm way that makes you just want to read on and on and on, even though you're observing these people that you're talking about and the odd things they do surrounding food, and it's just very interesting. One fellow, I can't remember what his name is, but he goes on this 27-year quest to find the perfect piece of meat. I mean, and this whole thing, this Fleischgeist, you know, the meat party. And this is not a sustainable anything that moves sort of endeavor.
No. Maurice Dreiser is the person you're thinking of. And I came across him because I was researching this aspect of the food movement that I find really interesting, which is the propensity toward encyclopedic eating and eating at every ramen restaurant in the tri-state area and documenting it on a blog, or just the thoroughness with which foodies pursue their food obsessions seems to be a feature of this moment. And I stumbled across an obituary of a fellow who spent 27 years searching for the perfect steak. So he undertook this beginning in mid-century, 1940s. So the idea of, he was a man of his time in that way. You know, the thing he was seeking was the thing that was the lingua franca in American dining at that time, fine dining, was a steak. That has changed so much. So that alone is instructional we would never think of, nobody would undertake that quest today. It would be a different quest. It would be the best, balut or something like that, which is something else I talk about in the book. But he had a family fortune, and he spent quite a bit of it traveling the world and trying to find the perfect steak. And he would take a doctor's leather satchel full of instruments that he had devised and patented for testing steaks and other delicacies. And he was such a character, and he was, in other ways, you know, he representative of the mid-century idea of the gourmet. He was a rich white guy living in New York City and feeding him, you know, funding his house with a trust fund. He's so different from the foodie. A foodie is a term that can apply to somebody of any background in any part of the country and is often a young person. But in other ways, he predicted the foodie movement. He was a really impassioned amateur who went out there and basically tried to professionalize his habit. He got in a lot of trouble with the IRS because he was taking huge write-offs for his lifestyle, and the IRS at that point just didn't know what to do with him, and they eventually told him he had to pay up.
That's good. But he never really found... Did he find the perfect steak?
I don't think he wanted to find the perfect steak.
Right.
He wanted to keep on pressing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and then talk about some of the movement with the Fleischgeist, you know, these meat parties, and you attended one of these. The whole meat thing is, yeah, it's beyond.
There is a real grappling with meat that's going on in this country. I think it's in the wake of concerns being raised about meat. People in this country are trying to figure out how we feel about it and in what context we want to eat it and what we need to know about the meat in order to feel good about eating it. And sometimes that has a kind of frenzied, bacchanalian feel to it.
Uh-huh.
Often it's really thoughtful. You know, there's this butchery movement, and the new wave butchery movement is young people or the shop owners, it used to be a hereditary position being a butcher, and it used to be exclusively male. I mean, the idea of a female butcher is so eccentric if you think about, 20th century America. Well, the butcher shop that I go to in Los Angeles is two women, and they are, one of them was a vegetarian, and they learned how to butcher, and they opened this shop, and it's all the meat is sustainable, hormone-free, ethical meat, and it's become a real center of the food community in LA, and it draws people from, I don't know if people in Park City are into the paleo diet, but it draws people who are into that, and it also, you know, is for other, you know, foodies and home cooks, and they supply some of the great restaurants in town, and anybody who it's become sort of a get across the food spectrum.
Our guest is Dana Goodyear, and the book is Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture, just in time for the holidays. And Dana Goodyear, thank you so much for joining us today. You're listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Your daughter takes a fall on her bike, and you're not sure what's really going on with her aches and pains. I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino at Intermountain Instacare. We gladly accept walk-in patients. No appointment needed. Our Instacare in Park City is located at 1665 Bonanza Drive. We have a new call-ahead number to reserve an arrival time. Call 435-649-7705. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
The ABC4 Weather Report comes to you live Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. after the NPR News. Brought to you by Albion Financial Group.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Want to thank our underwriters today, Grand Valley Bank, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Park City Clinic, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Prudential Utah Real Estate, and San Francisco Design. You can also access archive shows at kpcw.org. You're listening to KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City. Time now for news. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving, everyone.